Hello, I'm Meshack Scannelberry, and this is number 0246, the Stuff File Program, with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0246. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, you'll meet Christopher Dorado, who is the author of the novel The Geography of Pluto. What does Pluto have to do with a coming-of-age story?
It kind of represents the loss of innocence. When Pluto was demoted as a planet a number of years ago in 2006, it kind of had a bit of an effect on me. Like, it was one of those things that I thought would always be there. You know, it's like one of those things that you're taught about in school. You know, the universe has so many planets. You've got a sun. And for Pluto all of a sudden not to be considered a planet anymore, it just kind of really shook me to my core in a sense. It was like, what is there in the universe that I can count on if what I've been told my entire life to be true isn't true anymore?
Charles B. Crenshaw Jr., a veteran, a yogi, and the author of The Painless Path. How did he first get into teaching yoga?
It started off where I studied physical postures. I actually practiced meditation for many years after I got out of service, before I met my teacher. Then I practiced physical culture along with meditation. And the teaching part just evolved. It wasn't something that I asked for. I was only looking for something to help myself. And it just evolved kind of little by little to where it is today.
Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, shares a slice of the Big Apple from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge, including about when cops and firefighters go to the funerals of fellow officers and first responders.
For all the funerals that were taken after 9/11, the cops and the firemen, according to their union contracts, were paid to go. In other words, it was on company time. And that's a requirement and a demand of the New York City Police Department employees and the New York City Fire Department. So when you see hundreds of them going to their brethren, there's a little more to it than what meets the eye.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0246 was my nephew, Meshack Scandalberry. Thank you very much, Meshack, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File Program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Here's a quote that really isn't a strong defense in this case. I saw her light on and I went over to say hello. That's what Efren Carrillo told police. Carrillo's girlfriend had just dropped him off at his San Jose, California home after a party, and he said he saw his neighbor's light on and went over for a drink. It was 3:30 a.m., and the frightened neighbor woman called police. Efren, a Sonoma County supervisor, was arrested for attempted burglary and prowling, but that was reduced later to peeking into a neighbor's window, which is a misdemeanor. He faces up to 6 months in jail. He has pleaded not guilty and refuses to resign from his office. It's not just a simple misunderstanding, though. It was a bad read, he told police. A misperception on my part. Also, in retrospect, I should have had my pants on. Yeah, talk about bearing the lead there, huh? Not wearing any pants? Well then, finally, a city official who apparently has nothing to hide. Yes. Meanwhile, a 37-year-old by the name of Cornelius Anderson was convicted of armed robbery in St. Louis, Missouri, and was sentenced to 13 years in prison and told to await instructions on when and where to report for his sentence. Well, he waited, and he waited. After 13 years of waiting, the Missouri Department of Corrections realized its clerical error. They sent a SWAT team to his house, says Anderson's attorney, Patrick McGarro. He was getting his 3-year-old daughter breakfast, and these men with automatic weapons bang on his door. Now, while waiting for the state, Anderson got married, got a job, paid his taxes, and lived openly under his real name. The SWAT team hauled him off to prison. McGarro has filed a motion for Anderson's release, saying the state had its chance to imprison him but missed their chance. You know, the state is probably just mad about the fact that when they went to let him out 13 years later, they suddenly realized that he wasn't there. Yeah. Meanwhile, nobody disputes that 39-year-old James Jewell killed himself by putting a gun to his temple and pulling the trigger. Jewell's family, however, disputes the Oklahoma County, Michigan Medical Examiner's Office's determination of what they call suicide. "I was there. I know that was not what he wanted to do," said Jewell's girlfriend, Jennifer Jackson. Jackson said Jewell was trying to convince her to keep a gun in her nightstand, but she was afraid to get one. To help alleviate her fears, Jewell demonstrated how you can do all these hundreds of little actions and nothing would happen. Then, according to Jackson, he said, "Look, I'll show you one more time." That's when he put it to his head and it went off. The medical examiner's office is standing by its ruling. The victim applied the gun to his temple, unfortunately, and pulled the trigger, according to the medical examiner, which constitutes a set series of purposeful acts. Folks, as I've said on this program time and time again, it's just the Darwin file at work. Because as you know, the tree of life is often self-pruning. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, "I'm simply trying to sell burgers," says John Schmidt, owner of the Lunchbox Laboratory Restaurants in Seattle, Washington. When he noticed that Easter fell on April 20th this year, he associated 420 with the slang for marijuana. That progressed to an advertisement, which he emailed to 13,000 customers, showing Jesus holding a hamburger and a marijuana joint to promote a buy one, get one free burger offer. "Now, the chatter is much more than I anticipated," Schmidt admitted. His customers apparently didn't complain, but the conservative media went ballistic. "I didn't put it on TV," Schmidt shrugged. "We're just trying to sell sandwiches. If you're looking to me for moral direction, you're probably misguided." I like that quote. You know, that's calm reason, and that calm reason usually trumps sputtering outrage in most cases. But talk about grease your palm Sunday. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? Christopher Dorado is a Montreal author who has published a novel called The Geography of Pluto. As the press release states, it's the story of a young man's day-to-day struggle with uncertainty. And Chris knows a thing or two about press releases because he's also been a publicist for several years. But now the shoe is on the other foot. And Chris joins us on the line from right here in Montreal. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Peter.
Thanks for being on the program with us. Right off the bat, I got to ask, what does the title mean, The Geography of Pluto?
Well, my main character is a Montreal geography teacher. So he teaches geography to a bunch of high school students. And so, you know, his subject matter is always in the front of his mind. And Pluto is, well, for me anyway, it kind of represents the loss of innocence. I don't know about you, but, you know, when Pluto was demoted as a planet a number of years ago in 2006, it kind of had a bit of an effect on me. Like, it was one of those things that I thought would always be there. You know, it's like one of those things that you're taught about in school. You know, the universe has so many planets, you've got a sun. And for Pluto all of a sudden not to be considered a planet anymore, it just kind of really shook me to my core in a sense. It was like, what is there in the universe that I can count on if, you know, if what I've been told my entire life to be true isn't true anymore? So for me, it was just kind of a real representation of kind of the loss of innocence, of change, kind of the certainty of change in life. Because, you know, my main character, it's a bit of a coming of age story. He's learning a lot of life lessons about, you know, falling in love, about death. And, you know, Pluto kind of represents, you know, uncertainty. And so for him being a geography teacher, you know, looking at maps, looking at society, looking at the way we live our lives, Pluto represents really, you know, the great unknown.
They always say when you're writing that you should write what you know. This is your first novel, so where did this story come from?
Well, you know, like most people out there, you know, I've fallen in love and I've had my heart broken. And for me, although the story isn't autobiographical, I say that its spirit is in a way. You know, you You know, when you fall in love for the first time, you, in a weird way, you kind of think it's going to be forever. And, you know, when it happened to me and you know, it was over, I found myself really surprised. I was surprised at how the other person felt, but I was also kind of surprised at how poorly I took it and how affected I was by it. So it got me thinking about the other relationships in my life, namely the relationship I have with my mother. I'm quite close with my mom. You know, we see each other every week. We talk on the phone every day. She's really kind of a constant thing in my universe. And it started getting me to wonder what it would be like if I had lost her. And, you know, it just kind of put me down this whole kind of path where I was taking these two relationships, kind of the first love and kind of another first love, really, which is the mother's love for her son, and kind of contrasting them both together and kind of putting them, you know, lining them up next to each other. So my main character is kind of going through this situation where his first love is kind of now over, and also his mother's kind of in remission from cancer. So, you know, it's about love, it's about loss, and those are the kind of the two themes I really wanted to explore in the book.
You say it's not biographical, yet you say there's a similarity in talking about first love. So was writing this book in any way, shape, or form cathartic for you?
Completely. Like, you know, I think I started writing after a breakup that I have, and it's a bit of a cliche for a writer to kind of start writing after a breakup. But, you know, for me it was a way that I could just kind of put things into perspective because things didn't really necessarily make sense to me. And I'm talking about a journal here. I wasn't really thinking of this as a novel. But after a while, I looked at what I had written and I realized, you know what, there's some kind of universal truth here to this. I'm not the only one that thinks this way. And I should say, too, that I'm a gay man, and the character in my book is a gay man. And, you know, I would talk to other gay men a bit about, you know, what I was writing. And they, too, were kind of, there was kind of a connection there. They could kind of see where I was kind of coming from, and they could kind of see the relationship with the mother. But all that to say that I don't think it's kind of limited to, you know, an audience of gay people. I mean, the book really is just kind of universal, and it's about love, and it's about connection. So whether it be with, you know, the connection between, like I said, a parent and a son, or between a person and a significant other, it's really just kind of about how we relate as people.
I mentioned in the introduction that you've also worked in the past as a publicist. So what is it like to have literally the shoe on the other foot?
It's kind of amazing. I mean, you know, I grew up wanting to be a writer. I grew up not really even knowing how to write. You know, like I would read books and I'd try to write, and I found a lot of the time that I'd be basically trying to write the same story over again that I was reading. But over time, you know, I just kind of kept at it. And I got a job as a publicist, and my job as a publicist was really in the literary world. So I was working for a lot of organizations, Canadian organizations like the Canada Council for the Arts. I was working for the Quebec Writers Federation. In Montreal, I was working for the Blue Metropolis Foundation, which is a literary festival. And it really kept me around writers, so I really got to be inspired by them. And if I ever felt a little bit down and out and uninspired and hitting writer's block, I was kind of surrounded by these people who they themselves had been through what I went through. So it was really inspiring, and it really just kept me going because I knew that I wanted to be on the other end of things. I wanted to be the person who, instead of was setting up the interview, was being interviewed like I am today with you.
You know, it's funny. It almost, to use another analogy, you meet young actors who get a job at a casting agency and read lines with actors who are auditioning. It sounds like it's a similar situation with you being a press person.
Yeah, you know, I really do think it's important for you to follow your dream, and until you get your dream, to kind of immerse yourself in your dream. So yeah, so if you're an actor and you're going to a casting agent, or working for a casting agent, or just doing whatever it is that you can do, it really is helpful. I mean, I've done a lot of volunteer work in my life, not to say that I was volunteering as a publicist, but, you know, I would have volunteered if it really meant that I would actually be around the people who might be able to help me one day, you know, who might be able to see in me something that, you know, I hadn't maybe even realized myself, which I think is the same that you could say about acting for sure.
So you've always wanted to be a writer. You've got this novel out. Everyone has goals and dreams and envisions how well things are going to go. Obviously, you have high hopes with this book, The Geography of Pluto. Do you envision, because of the kind of story that it is, it's a very modern tale, a very modern story. Do you envision that perhaps it goes beyond the pages that you've put them on, say perhaps done as a film?
You know, I'd kind of like that. I actually had a conversation today with a friend of mine who I'd given an advanced copy to, and he read it, and he said, you know what, Chris, it's really cinematic. And I was like, really? Like, you know, for me, I was like, you know, I'm seeing it in one way, but he's seeing it in another, and he's a person who is a filmmaker. And I would love that. Honestly, I would love that. I love, you know, I love it when a book is made into a film. Oftentimes, you know, if I found out that a film is coming out, I'll actually run out, if I find out there was a book the film was based on, I'll actually kind of go and buy the book first and read it and then kind of compare the two. So I would love it. I mean, I probably wouldn't do it myself. I, you know, I don't think that I have the skills to do that, but I know there are other people out there that are really good at adaptations and are able to take a story, a beloved story, and bring it to also a whole new audience in a whole new different way. I think that's the great thing too, when you know, you can experience a story, a whole new work in a different medium.
So your baby's finally out there. The book is The Geography of Pluto. Now that it's done, you mentioned you're close to your mom. What does mom think about it?
She isn't ready yet. I have to say, she wants to wait. My book actually comes out on the 10th of May. So it's kind of available now in like limited quantity. So I'm doing a big party on the 8th of May, and she wants to wait to the party to kind of pick up her own copy. So I have to say, I mean, there is a part of me that is a little bit concerned about what she'll think. Like I said, it's not autobiographical, but I know that she'll see me in the story. And because it's a relationship between the son and her mother, I'm pretty sure she'll probably also see herself. So there is that kind of concern. But I think she, you know, she loves me. She's supportive of me. And I, you know, I'm sure she's going to see something in it that she's very proud of.
Mothers always know their kids, but what about your friends? Do you, if your friends read this book, will they see Christopher Dorado in it?
I think probably they will. And sometimes I have to say they'll probably be wrong. They'll probably say to me, oh my God, this is totally you. I, this sounds totally like you. Is this something that you did? And I'll have to say, actually, no. You know, it's something you did, because I do also kind of mine the lives of my friends, too, in moments for this. So, you know, but whether or not people think it's me, I guess I'm not trying to kind of worry too much about that. Basically, I just want people to be able to lose themselves in the book, in the world of the book, and maybe leave with it with a bit different understanding about life and about love and the way that we connect as human beings.
The book is called The Geography of Pluto, written by Christopher Dorado. And people can take a look at your website as well, which is ChristopherDorado.com. Chris, I thank you very, very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you, Peter.
Christopher Dorado, author of The Geography of Pluto. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0246, and you'll find links to both Christopher's website and also links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick. You know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands, just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Coming to you from the outskirts of sanity, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of The Pathless Path, God, Grace, Guru. We'll have a visit from Peter Franklin, our favorite taxi driver, another edition of the Gabby Cabby. And there is indeed an idiot of the day coming your way. And of course, much more Stuff File news on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Okay, here's a quote. Something I appreciate about being on the train is I can rest or relax. Those are the words of 23-year-old Jessica Method, who commutes from San Jose, California by train to her job at Stanford University. But on the way home one night, she relaxed too much. She fell asleep on the train. I woke up and I was on the train and there was nobody on the train, and then I realized I was in the train yard, she said. It was past midnight, she was locked in, and her cell phone was dead. She found a conductor's car unlocked and was able to use the train's radio to call for help. Caltrain officials said employees were disciplined for not making sure the cars were empty before leaving it. Yeah. Okay, here's the part of the story that I have a hard time believing. Everyone just expects us all to believe that commuter trains in the Silicon Valley don't have a place to plug in cell phones. Or she could have left the plug at home or at the office. Who knows? Anyway, here's the latest case of zero tolerance gone mad. If you listen to this program enough, you know that zero tolerance stories really bunch my shorts in a knot. I mean, they just annoy me. So here's the latest one. Galesburg, Illinois High School tried to fix a problem by issuing a zero tolerance policy. Things like people texting in purses, in classes, or inappropriate items coming into class, according to Principal Roy Van Meter. And so it wasn't a single incident. It wasn't even two or three. It was a combination of all those. So the new rule? The school banned all purses. That's why Carrie Harding's 17-year-old daughter got an in-school suspension. She brought a clutch purse into the school. She carries her personal feminine napkins in it, hand sanitizing lotion, and wipes during her monthly cycle. Harding says, adding that the school told her an exception could be made if she gets a doctor's note documenting a medical condition. Her mother said, "Really? A medical condition? I mean, every woman has it every month. It's not a medical condition, it's nature." She says that when it comes to rules, checking for weapons and checking for drugs and checking for all that, I am in compliance with that all the way. But this was the last straw. See, that's what it will take to stop zero tolerance, apparently. Enough parents getting to that last straw. I'm assuming that there wasn't a single woman involved in the implementation of this idiotic rule. Not one. Anyway, we have a couple of stories with compelling explanations. First, 25-year-old Wendy Simpson, in explaining her DUI arrest during a March incident in Huddersfield, England, pointed out that she had just minutes earlier walked to a McDonald's for a late-night meal because she knew she was too inebriated to drive. However, the dining room was closed, and she was refused service at the drive-thru window because she was on foot, and she said the only option left was for her to go home, get her car, and return to the drive-thru. On the way back, she was arrested. Yeah. Okay, I almost feel for her plight in this case. Almost. Not quite, but almost. But this next guy, I have no sympathy for. Among the arguments offered in March by Darius Mathis's lawyers for his jury trial in Cobb County, Georgia, for assault, kidnapping, and carjacking, was the assertion that Mathis needed no force in order to have sex with the female victim on the night in question because Mathis is such a good-looking man. However, the jury was not so dazzled and convicted him on all charges. Okay, Darius may have been good-looking, but what he really needed was a lawyer who could make better legal arguments. And by the way, Darius, I've seen your pictures. Perhaps you should also be concerned about how your lawyer, Carter Clayton, is looking at you. Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a California model, Elizabeth Dixon, filed a lawsuit in Los Angeles in March against Playboy Enterprises for an injury she suffered as a guest on a Playboy Channel cable TV show in 2012 when she allowed host Kevin Kline to tee a golf ball off her rear end. According to the $500,000 lawsuit, Kline took a swing at the ball that was teed between her cheeks, missed, and struck her buttocks hard, causing her pain, suffering, worrying, and anxiety. Okay, let's figure this one out, shall we? You've lined up the shot, but to hold the tee, you have to clench the butt cheeks. Now, to clench the butt cheeks, the butt actually rises. Now, with the rising butt, the distance from club to behind is decreased. Without making the proper adjustments, one could see how the butt could be hit. Okay, I've already spent too much time thinking about this, and I'm not even involved in the case. I mean, that was about 30 seconds of thought that I'll never get back, so my heart goes out to the judge in this one. Wow. Anyway, let's get to our next guest on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? Reverend Charles B. Crenshaw Jr. grew up in a tough inner city, yet he didn't grow up to be a criminal. On the contrary, he is a veteran, and he is a yogi, and the co-founder of a non-profit educational organization that teaches yoga and meditation. He's also the author of The Pathless Path, God, Grace, Guru. And Charles joins us on the line from Indianapolis right now. Hi, Charles.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. Thanks for being on the program with us. How does someone like yourself, with the background I just mentioned, and let's be honest, you're also black, you're an African-American, it's not something you often hear about somebody like that going into yoga. How did it start for you?
It started in church, like most people with my background, and it evolved being taken to Asia when I was in the service. And bumping into Buddhism, and there, it blossomed into meeting my teacher who came here to Indianapolis, who was a yogi.
Now, it's one thing, though, to be a practitioner of yoga, but you have since become a teacher. So what was that leap for you like, and why did you do it?
It started off where I studied the physical posture. I actually practiced meditation for many years after I got out of the service, before I met my teacher. And then I practiced physical culture along with meditation. And the teaching part just evolved. It wasn't something that I asked for. I was only looking for something to help myself. And it just evolved kind of little by little to where it is today.
And now you've written this book, The Pathless Path, God, Grace, Guru. For whom did you write this book for?
I wrote the book. The book is a universal book, even though the subtitle is An African-American Life Transformed Through the Practice of Yoga and Meditation. This is for anybody who is looking to understand how yoga is a tool for the evolution of human consciousness.
So this book would be a great tool for the beginner, or is it somebody that needs to have a knowledge of yoga to start with?
Nope, it'd be for the beginner and even for the knowledgeable one. Everybody would get something at their own level. It's not a book about practicing physical postures. It's a book about the undergirding science of yoga, which anybody can have access to.
Now, I introduced you as Reverend Charles B. Crenshaw, Jr., and that's a title that you have had since becoming a yogi, correct?
Yes, in essence, yes.
And but as you said, you grew up in the church, so I'm just wondering, for people who might already be people of faith and people who are religious, does what you teach is it in addition to whatever they might believe and what their faith is, or does it conflict with that? Is it a separate situation, a separate religion, or does it meld well with whatever somebody currently believes in?
It melds well with whatever someone currently believes in. And my seminary where I train, which was founded by a very famous yogi in association with some others, Swami Satchidananda, and a very famous old Hasidic rabbi named Joseph Guberman, they founded a seminary, and its basis, its motto was never instead of, always in addition to what you understand about faith, what you understand about religion. There's your understanding, there's my understanding, our understanding as one helps us to move forward. So yoga is, in that sense, yoga actually is related to meditation, is something that could be the thread that could bind all the religious traditions. So it's not contrary to someone's religion. You take the aspects of it, you use it in your own tradition.
Now, in the introduction that I gave at the beginning of talking to you, I mentioned the fact that you grew up in the tough inner city, but you didn't become a criminal, and that you went into the military, and you became, later you became a yogi. But there's not a linear situation here. It's not a connecting the dots kind of thing. Just growing up in the tough neighborhood, you didn't succumb to what was going on around you in your environment. I'm assuming that just saying that, you are a strong-willed personality, correct?
The fabulous thing in communities like this is family. So I can say I'm a strong-willed person, but I can really attribute a lot of it to my mother and my father and my family, which were like the beacon of light, that and the church where I grew up. Those were the things. So I can't necessarily say it's strong-willed. I know that it's the undergirding of a family.
The reason why I asked the question is because you are in a situation now where you are sharing these teachings and you're a man of peace, and I'm just wondering if what you are doing now, if it can be really, really helpful to those who are in a dark and maybe dangerous place.
Yes, it can, because one of the things that we need to understand is the great power of people like Gandhi and Dr. King and Mandela. And we can only, all the texts say, you know, hate's not overcome by hate, hate's overcome by love. And meditation is something that can help a person to find that place in themselves to respond from a nonviolent perspective. You know, to tap into the place, the power that Mandela had, the power that Dr. King had, that Gandhi had. And it's not something you have to think about. The meditation practice helps it evolve in you, and it's just there. It's a power that's there. I firmly believe that. I see that in my life.
You are also the co-founder of a nonprofit educational organization called Inner Peace Yoga Center, which is in Indianapolis. Tell us a little bit about the center.
Well, we teach the tradition. We teach no hype. We teach meditation. We teach the physical postures. We teach the basics of Ayurveda, which is the science of health and longevity that's founded in the Vedic tradition. And just simple things, step-by-step, systematic. We firmly are grounded in the tradition of the sages, from teacher to student, from teacher to student, a lineage that goes back longer than the United States or the West has been involved, okay? So some people say 5,000 years, but my teacher said it's longer than that. So we just steadily teach the tradition as we have been taught it.
And how does practicing what you practice as a yogi, how does it help you with things that you have had to deal with in your past, like being in the Vietnam War, for instance?
So the one thing I teach at the University of Phoenix, I teach critical thinking, a class on critical thinking and creative minds. So it helps you. It's my firm belief in doing this, my experience. It helps you to think critically, helps you to weed out the useless things so that you can live a nice, clear life. It kind of takes you above the fray. And so that would go for my experience in the neighborhood I grew in, my experience in Vietnam, my experience in the world today, because we really need more people who are working from this basis of nonviolence so we can quell all the turmoil that's in the world, because we're not doing it so well the other way.
Words of wisdom. The book is called The Pathless Path, God, Grace, Guru. It's written by Reverend Charles B. Crenshaw, Jr. Reverend Charles, I thank you very, very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you very much.
Charles B. Crenshaw, Jr., author of The Pathless Path, God, Grace, Guru. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0246, and you'll find links to both Charles's website and links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. How many of your tax dollars go to pay for lawsuits? Unfortunately, government officials don't file reports on this, so we'll never know how high our tax-funded lawsuit bill is. Yet every once in a while, a government watchdog group will investigate this, and a report out of Chicago sheds some light on just how big this problem is. According to the Chicago Sun-Times, taxpayers in the Windy City paid more than $500 million on police-related lawsuits alone over the past decade. That's right, one city department responsible for $500 million in lawsuits. Let's be fair, a large number of these lawsuits are frivolous. Some are not. As with any large organization, there's always a few bad apples. Experts point out that police disciplinary systems in many cities need to be fixed. But only a few bad cops can create a lot of big problems, not only for their victims, but for the rest of us as taxpayers. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, the Stuff File presents the Gabby Cabby, direct from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge in the city that never sleeps, New York. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And yes, we do indeed have Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby. Hello, sir.
Hello, hello, live from the streets of New York.
Nice to talk to you once again. You know, one of the things everyone seems to be talking about these days, and it's the one thing that always fascinates me about the American political system. You talk about elections the second the last one is over. Racing to 2016, I understand. Two New Yorkers, basically, although one's not really a New Yorker, but two New Yorkers are vying for chances to be president.
Well, actually, Peter, you're a little bit late because the 2016 election has already been held. See, we go very fast. We're now working on the one after that. No, but seriously speaking, yeah, New York City wants to get the Democratic convention here, and what it's betting on is the fact that, as the expression goes, two of the favorite sons or daughters. You have Andrew Cuomo, who is the governor of the state of New York. He has his heart set on being president, and I guess his daddy, the former governor, also wants his kid to win. And then, of course, you got Hillary Clinton, who is a front runner. So New York is saying, well, listen, we're a Democratic city, and two of the leading candidates are, you know, from here. So give us the convention, and here's what we'll do for you. And that will be basically a payoff to the Democratic convention, the Democratic Party, that is, so that we end up getting it, so that in theory everybody in New York is going to make a fortune out of it, but that never, never happens and will not happen. As a matter of fact, I guarantee you it will be something like the profitability of the Olympics in Vancouver.
Actually, they did pretty well. It's the ones in Montreal that were problematic in 1976.
Okay, well, we'll do that one instead.
Okay. So under that theory, then, can we expect the Republican National Convention would be in New Jersey?
Yeah, well, I don't know where that can be. Maybe we ought to have it in Montreal or Vancouver. It would be nice.
In any case, moving right along, what is this story about the Department of Health and mental hygiene doing tank inspections?
Well, here's the thing. Have you ever seen in New York City, when you've been here, all of the... you're talking about the water towers now, aren't you?
Yeah.
The water towers that are on tops of all the buildings.
I've seen some of them. I haven't been to New York in a long time, but I've seen some of them. And lately, in some television shows, it's interesting. There's stories of you know, bodies being found in them and whatnot.
Well, yeah, but here's the thing. Because the buildings are so tall, unless you pump the water up into the water towers, tanks, whatever you want to call them, you would have very bad pressure for the water coming to you in your apartment. Plus, you'd get a pulsating kind of effect as the pump was pumping it. So just about every single tall building in New York City has a water tower on top, and the water goes up there, and then it comes down by gravity, and that's why you get very good pressure. Well, frankly, whatever they're saying on television, I don't know anything about that because it's not really true. We've been remarkably lucky in the sense that people haven't gotten sick from contaminated water towers for certainly in my adult lifetime. And now the city has decided, which I think is a good thing, to start checking them more than it has up to this point. So a little attention is being put on New York skyline, and it's kind of nice because it is an interesting skyline with all the water towers.
And in a dark kind of story, I understand some members of the NYPD and the FDNY, the fire department, have pleaded guilty to, shall we say, some fraud pertaining to illnesses?
Well, we're talking about hundreds here. We're not talking about three cops or four firemen. We are talking about hundreds of cops and firemen who have been receiving disability payments because of injuries they claim they have gotten, which they haven't. And the way it got picked up is that some of the disability payments came out of our Social Security system, which is actually a federal system. So makes one wonder why the New York City Police Department, the New York City Fire Department, didn't discover all these fakers, and it required the interest of a federal agency, which basically would have almost nothing to do with it. And it is a shame, because I think, I don't know, you say they should be held to a high standard, they certainly should, but the amazing thing is, we're talking about hundreds of cops and firemen who pulled the swindle. And by the way, just as an added little dig I'd like to throw in here so everybody understands it, for all the funerals that were taken after 9/11, the cops and the firemen, according to their union contracts, were paid to go.
Now, when you say paid to go, it's like going to a funeral is a regular shift to them? Or were they paid more than
that? That's right. That's right. That's exactly what it was. In other words, it was on company time, and that's a requirement and a demand of the New York City Police Department employees and the New York City Fire Department. So when you see hundreds of them going to their brethren, there's a little more to it than what meets the eye.
Okay, and you know, neither here nor there, but is that something that people find upsetting?
Well, now it is, because they're figuring that, hey, we got this situation, which is not really right, okay? When was the last time you were paid to go to a funeral? And in addition to that, we're now finding out hundreds have been taking their disability when they shouldn't have been. So, yeah, it's a souring situation.
Well, you know, to be honest, whenever there's a death of a fire, well, for instance, a death of a police officer in almost any city, the fire departments or the police departments of other cities send a contingent to that city. I mean, it's happened here in Montreal. Whenever there's a police death in another part of Canada or in some cases the United States, especially if somebody dies in the line of duty, members of the Montreal contingent go and are part of the officers that go along. And I'm certain they're on duty, per se, and therefore being paid when they go. So that part doesn't surprise me.
Well, it's not a surprise. It's just that it's a fact of life, and that coupled with all these disability payments has a lot of people kind of upset about it.
Yeah, the disability part I completely understand. In any case, moving on to other things, there was that situation with a particular Yankee pitcher, and I know you listened to some of the conversations that take place in the back of the hack. What are people in the cab talking about, Michael Pineda?
Well, you know, he's a guy who is not too bright because he got caught putting some stuff on his fingers, which made it possible for him to manipulate the ball when he pitched it. And then he turns around and does it again, the same team, the same coach that he's up against. And, of course, that was too much. And of course, now he's been thrown out of, baseball for a few days as a penalty. Well, two observations about this. First of all, I've yet to run into anybody who thinks it's wrong. You can read that any way you want. But they figure that, well, everybody cheats, so what's the big deal? He can cheat. It's sort of like the guys that take the steroids and everything. I guess it's okay to cheat if you're a professional athlete, which, of course, is a ridiculous concept, but it is too. Now, the other thing, which I think is kind of interesting, and I don't know whether any of the sports writers up in Canada picked this up, they made a big deal about the fact that he was suspended for the next six games. Well, as a pitcher, he wouldn't have played in the next six games. Maybe he would have played once in the next six games. So he didn't get a six-game suspension. He got a one-game suspension. And it's strange that I've yet to see any sports writer point that out. And so people are under the illusion, unless they know baseball, like I know baseball, he didn't get a six-day suspension. He got a one-day suspension.
Right, right. Well, you know, the people you often call the Yankees the bums, and that's the segue to someone who actually was looking like a bum on the street and got some money, but it really wasn't the bum, right?
Yeah, well, it's a terrific story. It really is. Richard Gere is in New York, on the streets of New York, and he's filming a movie, and he's dressed as a bum, and he's standing next to a garbage can. A lady walks over and offers him something to eat. And he takes it with a straight face. And that was the end of it until it came out in the newspapers. Now, I would have been the first, and maybe I was the first, to say, the story's a bunch of baloney. It was just made up by some public relations guy. But no, it turns out it really wasn't a bunch of baloney. It was a tourist who really didn't know who he was and was flabbergasted the next day when somebody pointed out to her who the man was. Then she knew who Richard Gere is, because after all, he's been around in movies for, 40 years. So it's a charming, funny story. And that, frankly, happens to me all the time. When I'm walking on the streets of New York, people usually come up to me and say, do you need any food or money?
and speaking of spotting people on the street, I understand you had a really, really, shall we say, sexy celebrity sighting.
Yeah, for an old broad, she's looking really good. I'm talking about Sophia Loren, and the reason I saw her, and a lot of people saw her, along with Robert De Niro and other celebrities, is we have something here called the Tribeca Film Festival. And it's a big deal, and they exhibit a lot of movies, new movies and what have you. And, of course, she being the, I guess, the patron saint almost of movie land, was there. And I must tell you, I'm not sure, you're the master of all trivia, but I'll bet you she's in her late 80s.
Yep.
And she looked great.
Yep, she does look great. Were you drooling when you were watching her? I know.
No,
I would be.
I wasn't drooling. I only drool over my own wife.
Good answer. People can find out more information and even see some pictures of some of the things we were talking about by going to your website, which is www.gabby.com. They can also send you an email to peter@gabby.com. Thank you very much, sir, for being on the program once again.
Okay, bye-bye.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about out of racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We have a few more Stuff File news stories to share with you before we get to our idiot of the day. On a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, in March, the Canadian Radio, Television and Telecommunications Commission, or CRTC, reprimanded three pornography broadcast stations, not for excessively erotic fare, but for violating Canada's rules requiring that at least 35% of all content be Canadian origin. Yeah. According to its notice, the 24-hour AOV adult movie channel, also Triple X Action Clips, and Male Flicks, and Flicks is with three X's on the end, were falling short of the 8.5 hours a day of North of the Border sex action, and in an additional charge, were also hit for failing to provide enough closed captioning to accompany the yays and oh babies and oohs and ahs that normally show up on the soundtrack. Okay, now, here's my bone of contention, and that's no pun, by the way. If you need closed captioning to watch your porn, then you're way, way too involved in the plot. That's all I'm going to say. Anyway, moving right along. England's Stockport Magistrates Court levied the equivalent of a $13,000 fine in March against 42-year-old Lorraine White, who runs a part-time service as a dominatrix, you know, chaining up and whipping bad men. And she does this in a sex dungeon. I'm doing air quotes here. Her business is apparently perfectly legal. The citation was for violating fire codes because inspectors could not see how a client, being properly disciplined, you know, handcuffed and chained, might escape the dungeon in the event of a fire. Well, with the proper safe word, I would imagine. Yes. And Jermaine Jones certainly looked arresting when police officers in Lakewood, New Jersey first saw him. The 31-year-old was found naked under a stairwell, chewing glass and cigarette tobacco. Yeah. Officers were called to an apartment complex after receiving reports of a naked man riding a tricycle. When the officers questioned Jones, he allegedly admitted to smoking cocaine. Jones was transported to a local hospital where he was treated for minor cuts to his mouth. He was charged with a disorderly person's offense as well as being under the influence of a controlled dangerous substance. Jones was given clothes before posting for his mugshot. He had been released from state prison back in November after serving more than 2 years for a robbery conviction. Yeah, well, riding a tricycle naked and chewing on glass. Well, you know, I think Rick James once said it best. Cocaine is a hell of a drug. Wow. Tiffany Austin called television reporter at KTVU in March after being dismissed as a member of the Planet Fitness Gym in Richmond, California, after only one 15-minute workout. And you want to know why she was dismissed? Because she was too fit. Yes, and therefore making other members uncomfortable. Planet Fitness apparently takes seriously its business slogan guaranteeing no gymtimidation. Yes, that's a word they coined, gymtimidation, designed to keep out-of-shape women from feeling bad about themselves. Said another member to the reporter, "It's unfair to show off your body." So, let me get this straight. I guess based on that theory, none of the actual members are going to actually be fit enough to ever leave. Sounds like a captive business plan, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. How about using someone who is, quote-unquote, too fit as a possible model to what one can strive towards? How about that? How about a glass half full instead of a glass half empty theory? I'm just thinking out loud here, spitballing, as it were. You know? Anyway, a columnist for the Egyptian newspaper Al-Yam Al-Sabi proposed in March that Egypt sue Israel in international court for reparations for the 10 biblical plagues cast from Hebrew curses, including boils, lice, locusts, and turning the Nile River into blood. Ahmed al-Gamal asserted that Israelites swiped gold, silver, and other precious items as they began their legendary desert wandering. Al-Gamal also wants reparations from Turkey for the 16th century Ottoman invasion, from France for Napoleon's invasion in 1798, and Britain for 72 years of occupation. You know, the sad reality of all of this is that he might be able to find a lawyer who will take his case and tie up the courts forever. I hope I have the opportunity somewhere in the future to look back at this guy and call him the idiot of the day, but for now, he's not. He's just a moron working toward idiot of the day. However, this next item, this would be the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff file presents the idiot of the day.
37-year-old Evelyn Hamilton was arrested in Lufkin, Texas in April as merely the most recent person to complain to police that in a recent street transaction, she had been sold inferior marijuana. Seeds and residue, she whined to the nearest officer as she pulled a stash from her bra. Okay. If you're pulling inferior marijuana out of your bra to show a police officer in perhaps the misguided idea that somehow you are going to get an outcome that will satisfy your drug needs, then you, my dear, are an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0246. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links and all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0246. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Let me leave you with these words of wisdom. Never, ever juggle ice picks while standing on your waterbed.